You're up, we're up, it's the perfect match. Now it's on you to make the right decision while you're scrolling in bed. Cool off with a refreshing large Big Gulp drink at 7-Eleven. Cold, refreshing, and made the way you like it. It's available at 7-Eleven and just 59 cents with 7 rewards. Visit your local Columbus 7-Eleven and satisfy that craving today. Valid through 6/23/26. While supplies last, participating stores see app for full terms.
This is the New World Report. I'm John Batchelor with Professor Evan Ellis of the U.S. Army War College Strategic Studies Institute. An opinion piece in the Washington Post points to a story that's been ongoing for months, ever since the election of a young man named Pedro Castillo to be president of Peru. He subsequently has been jailed by the legislature and accused of treasonous acts. That has triggered a controversy throughout the Americas. Some leaders supporting Castillo, saying he's the legitimate president. Other leaders supporting the constitutional process. There's a dispute here about whether Castillo was extra-legal or not, or illegal, when he attempted to dissolve the legislature. However, we come now to an opinion piece. Ever since Peruvian President Pedro Castillo's failed power grab exactly 3 months ago, writes Jose Carlos Aguirre, who is described as a poet, an author of The Surrendered, Reflections by a Son of Shining Path. Ever since Peruvian President Pedro Castillo's failed power grab exactly 3 months ago, protests have been roiling the country almost every single day. The international press has had a difficult time grasping what is really happening here. Was it the work of Castillo supporters? Impoverished people from rural areas demanding social rights? There, I'll leave that question open for the professor. We've talked about this, indigenous people protesting not only in Peru, in Ecuador, in Chile, in Argentina, in Brazil, throughout the Americas. Indigenous people who are shoved aside or are used as labor in the mines or the large cities, but not empowered in a way that acknowledges that they were the possessors of this land before the colonial showed up 200 years ago or 100 years ago even. So this essay is very persuasive about the fact that stop looking at Castillo and what he did and start looking at the protests of the indigenous people, who in Peru, Professor, is my memory, were the broadcast understanding of why Castillo won, because he, a school teacher, represented the indigenous people. And that led in a close contest for his presidency. So how is it in Washington? How is it in American foreign policy? The power, the rights, the romance of the indigenous people of Peru.
Well, you have it exactly right, John. What this is really about in many ways is a combination of two things. On the one hand, as you alluded to, what's happening in Peru and more broadly, places like Bolivia and Ecuador, et cetera, it's about identity politics. It's about the question of those who feel themselves excluded from the wealth and the decision making, seeing their guy being booted out of power and apart from whatever the legalities may have been about why or did he follow the democratic processes or not, the sense of their person being excluded from power, they are excluded from power. And so we saw this in many ways in 2019, for example, when Evo Morales, who was basically caught red-handed trying to steal the elections in Bolivia, but it turned into an issue of essentially a right-wing transitional government of Jeanine Añez, trying to keep the people that he represented, the indigenous, that the people, the darker skinned people, the cocoleros, out. In the case of Peru, the same thing. Very clearly that Pedro Castillo had tried unconstitutionally to dissolve the Congress, something not in any way permitted, and yet the legalities of what he did for many of his protesters saw the basically white limeños who had always dominated and taken the proceeds from the mining, finding themselves once again excluded. Ironically, for example, there's something in Peru called called subsoil rights. The idea is if you're going to take something out of the ground that indigenous and other people are living on, there's some expectation that the mining company, others will take benefits. And so what you see in taking place is, you know, it was not only a protest against Castillo's exclusion, but also it spilled over into essentially trying to block mining roads and to kind of shut down some of the mines. It also had a compounding component, which is just the frustration with political instability and bad governments that goes all the way back to the neglect of these areas like Cajamarca, like the interior jungle regions, that goes much farther back. And so there's element of bad governance, but there's also a element of identity politics that really is coloring this. Although it appears in Peru, at least for the moment, that protests are dying down just a bit. The number of blockades, my last statistic was down from 90 blockades to 15. The major mines are up and running, especially the ones that were previously blocked. China's Minmetals, Las Bambas, Antapaque, as well as a smaller Constancia. Although there's some rumor that we may be in for a new round of protests and blockages, given that the transitional government of former Vice President Dina Boluarte has not resigned, and there's no path to get to elections, at least before 2024.
And then we have this from Bogota. The Human Rights Ombudsman of Colombia and Ecuador launched a joint alert system to prevent abuses by illegal armed groups from affecting AWA, indigenous communities that live along the country's shared border. The alert system will inform military leaders and government officials in both countries of potential attacks. So we go from the Peruvian situation, which is complex to say the least. Last time I checked, AMLO has not backed off in supporting Castillo in jail, and Castillo has not come to trial yet. But we also have the rising of Ecuadorian indigenous people and the trouble with the government there, and now reports of abuse by armed groups against the indigenous communities along the shared border. Is this all new, or is this a long-standing dispute that's getting attention from Reuters?
Well, John, it's all related to the fact that you had a plethora of indigenous groups who, of course, occupied the territory and lived there before the Spanish and Portuguese and other colonizers came. Some were integrated into politics, others remained excluded. So on the one hand, we have what we've seen the people who identify as indigenous and see themselves as still economically largely excluded from power, but who are at least kind of part of the system. But you also have groups who have basically lived largely in isolation. And as you're getting these new activities in remote locations, such as mining and illegal mining. For example, in recent weeks, we've talked about the Yanomami in Brazil, affected by illegal miners coming in. Or in Panama, you had the protests a couple months ago by a group who blocked highways, the Nobule. In Ecuador, of course, the AWA, as well as others, are impacted again by mining, as well as illegal armed groups that operate. Again, the groups that operate in these areas, they operate there because they tend to be very remote areas where there's limited government presence. But in part, there's limited government presence. Those are also the places that these isolated groups have come to live. And so in addition to the political problem of the indigenous, you have a problem basically that criminal activity and the absence of the state and armed groups, these are also putting some of those previously isolated groups in remote areas at risk. And so this about the AWA is really related to that, the need to protect or better protect some of these, previously isolated groups in remote areas.
I'm trying to imagine this conflict in so many different sovereignties, so many different kinds of presidents, left of center, right of center, undetermined. I'm trying to imagine where it's headed, because there seems to be, maybe because it's social media, maybe because Reuters is doing a really good job, it seems to be spontaneous risings. It doesn't seem to be a linkage. Sometimes I've seen reports that the indigenous people are used as a wedge to undermine the current government. But that would not be true of a left-of-center government. There's this other theme that left-of-center, the pink tide, is taking over the continent. I come to the example I read about here in North America, Professor. We all grew up with stories of how the colonials from Europe pushed into America across the Appalachians, spreading to the Pacific. But in doing so, of course, the abuse of the indigenous people of North America was catastrophic, tragic, and unacceptable, horrible, even to tell today. It's hard to believe that it happened. It's true in Canada as well. North America was a scene of abuse in the 19th century that today would be regarded as criminal. However, I puzzle, just because we solved it, the American Republic solved it by being brutal. The South American, the American republics have not been brutal. They've been appreciative of the native population. Yes, of course, the mines are in the regions where the native population, the indigenous, are the workers. What I'm winding up to with this long wandering around is, are we moving towards a continent-wide or an Americas-wide conference where all the indigenous people could come together and negotiate with the governments and some sort of, you know, Atlantic charter or Amazonian charter? Because they appear to be isolated without good resources, certainly not with good money. And the governments can take advantage of them or can ignore them.
Well, certainly, John, a continent-wide, indigenous identity is something that, especially from the perspective of indigenous politics, is raised for the time being. There are a diversity of different situations. One of the interesting things with the North American situation versus the region, of course, as you know, North America was largely colonized by families, people who came over to start new lives with wives, later children, and so the level of ethnic intermixing with the colonization of North America was relatively limited. And so, as you know, those who were not killed by diseases that the new colonizers had brought over, things like smallpox, there were the Indian Wars, people forced on reservations, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas in South America, especially Spanish ruled, but to an extent in Portuguese ruled South America, you had much more of a blending. You had essentially adventurers, single men coming over. And so you had a mixing of the populations. And so, you have decidedly groups, some, more, pure Spanish blood or pure Portuguese blood, but others, you have the vast majority of the population that has been mixed in ways. And so the racial identity politics of the United States, black, white, and to a certain degree, indigenous, is very different than the dynamics in Latin America. At the end of the day, it's still the issue of the darker skinned people oftentimes, winding up in economically and politically less favored positions, and the question of who appeals to them and whether it's on the basis of indigenous rights or on the basis of economic rights or some combination thereof. But certainly the question of the incorporation of people's indigenous identity and other identities into the region continues to be a theme that shapes politics across the region, Bolivia, Ecuador, Peru, et cetera.
It would appear that the leaders in these countries do not have the tools to resolve this, because we see in Lima and in Quito and in parts of Brazil, there's protests, certainly in Chile. And I remember it happening in Colombia during the Duque administration. Certainly, it's a constant running theme that the indigenous people protest. There are roadblocks or some sort of representation of the central government. Then it's forgotten, then it comes back. So does this weigh on conversation between the U.S. and Bogota, the U.S. and Brasilia? Do we talk about it?
Probably not in the sense of a pan-indigenous identity, but what you do see is that especially the Democratic administrations, but arguably for a long time, the question of how one treats and relates to marginalized or minority groups, that's definitely been a focus of the Biden administration, whether it's in its relationships with Brazil or Ecuador or even Mexico. If you take a look at the indigenous in Mexico, of course, was referred to as the cosmic race for that blending of Spanish and indigenous and others. But again, those groups who have received, or those remnants of, or integrated groups who have received less of the economic and political benefits, the question of how can one bring more development, more economic opportunity to those groups? Certainly the Biden administration has made that a kind of a key point in the current discourse. And indeed, you're seeing that across the region with the turn to the left. Left is not equal to indigenous, but certainly the issue of endangered groups and their or disadvantaged groups or marginalized groups and their relationship to governments has been one of the drivers, in combination with broader things like frustration over corruption and poor government performance, that is propelling the politics really across the region.
Professor Evan Ellis, U.S. Army War College Strategic Studies Institute. This is the New World Report. I'm John Patterson.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.